Oh.
No, no, here we go. Well, that's it. That's it. That's it. I had it in the wrong hole. Gotta be careful about that.
Shut up, Kevin.
Are we? Have we arrived?
We are recording. I was explaining that I thought we were recording earlier, but I stuck the pin in the wrong hole.
We've materialized.
That tends to be frowned upon. That'll get you in trouble.
It's the sound of our voices.
Definitely
that you've
not
been
something to do
for.
On the first date.
No, please. I'm not going to dignify your crude jokes today.
I will just keep repeating.
There's
them.
A lot of tasteful things to talk about today, no, so let's not.
There never is.
Let's not get off on that, shall
yeah.
we?
Yeah.
Hello, hey,
it's Marathon Chat,
No, we got a new theme song today.
Okay, go.
It's very appropriate to, it goes a little something like this, and this is like a little bumper of the chorus, so if you want to buy the single, you'll have to check it out later.
The extended remix featuring Chris Brown.
Yeah.
Beating up Rihanna.
It's very appropriate for today's subject, because today goes a little something like this.
Oh, no.
Well, 2000 podcast over, oops, out of time. Well, but tonight we're gonna talk about 1999. And now Prince is going to sue us.
See, I could do that last bit. I was trying to do the that little real hype, and I sounded like a cat going through puberty.
Kevin's gonna talk and tell some really stupid sexist jokes.
When it's time to change.
Joe's gonna go on forever about the marathons, and then until Kevin stops him from talking. Yeah, that I didn't do that much.
Prince, you didn't think that far ahead of the ride.
Prince will probably sue us now because
Prince listens to this marathon along with Stephen King, and
you might not know it, but I am a part-time Prince impersonator in my spare time.
Are you?
It's amazing how people confuse me for Prince.
You look amazing.
We're both small, although he's smaller than me.
Oh my God! What is he, a midget?
He's like, what, 4'1" or something?
Is he really?
Yeah. Prince is what, like 5'2",
Because he fit
5'2", 5'3".
I don't know.
He'll sue us.
You
now
look
for
at
that.
Me. You looked at me like I would know.
I don't
really
know.
What,
he's
don't
tiny.
Know.
That's all I know.
7 feet, 12 inches tall.
We're gonna get the cease and desist saying, "Dear,
please quit the unplugged Prince shows.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to talk about this thing called my lawsuit against you."
God, I didn't realize you were that much of a Prince fan.
I saw Purple Rain for the first time 2 months ago.
Really?
I was floored. Yeah, I waited that
long. I've never seen it.
You've never seen Purple Rain?
Mm-mm.
It's totally worth it.
I was like way too young for that to... I remember when that came out, I liked the soundtrack. And I actually asked my mom for the soundtrack. And that was a big deal because Darling Nikki's on there.
Oh, yeah.
And you listen to it now and you're like, that's it.
Yeah.
That's what made parents so crazy.
Everybody does that with a magazine, please.
Yeah, but I'm just like...
The kids today? It's great. It has probably one of the greatest 1-2 punch openings in any movie I've ever seen.
I may have to watch it sometime. We just did an 80s marathon.
Yeah, and you didn't show Purple Rain. That might have been a bit scandalous.
I showed Terminator. It's funny because I had R-rated stuff that I had at Breakfast Club. I had Terminator.
Oh, you could have shown Purple
Beverly
Rain.
Beverly Hills
then.
Cop, Revenge of the Nerds. Although Revenge of the Nerds gets a little rapey.
Just a bit.
Yeah.
Purple Rain.
16 Candles, Rain. Which was rated PG and had a full-blown boob shot.
Yeah,
also gets a little rapey.
You could get away with that stuff back then.
We're watching it. It was the first one we started watching. And it starts off with, it has Anthony Michael Hall, Jake Ryan. So the geek was going to, he's like, well, you take her home and you do whatever you want to with her because she's so drunk she can't even function. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
And it was like tossed out there. Like, this is the way it was in the 80s. It wasn't even, no one even batted. It wasn't even like, that's a great idea or that's horrible. It's just like, this is what happens.
That was from the earlier version of the script in which Anthony Michael Hall was played by James Spader. Oh, yeah, I'll take her home. Or somewhere like that.
Wow. And he crashes his car?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, then he has sex with her. And she's like, wait.
We should probably talk about...
Okay, let's get back on track. That was probably the farthest we've gone off track.
There's a lot to talk about today, ladies and gentlemen. A lot. Okay, so here's a little... background again for those of you who have not tuned into this podcast before, and if you haven't, what the hell's your problem?
Jeez.
Go back in the it's free for God's sake, and you have nothing else to do. I know you guys who listen to this podcast. You have you sit around in your basements, bloggers.
How
kids?
You suddenly just turned into the bitter
communists.
Old man. All of a sudden, in your basement, you bloggers.
I know
you stupid Twitter followers.
I know our audience, and they're like me. They have
Tumblr
nothing else
no
to do.
E.
Like me, they're all unemployed bloggers. Mm. So
yeah, you blog.
I do now. Yeah,
and you were struck down by the canceling of Hannibal.
Don't even get into that. Hannibal will never die. Yeah, if you want to read my thoughts about
not
Hannibal,
if Jason Stabler is dead has anything to say about
it. Jason Stabler is dead. That's S-T-A-E-B-L-E-R, oh, as in the character from The King of Marvin Gardens. You can read all about Hannibal. I just posted an epic essay last night about True Detective, the new season, which I think you might just be stricken by, like watching, viewing, gazing at the face of God. Wow. Yeah, so I don't know how we got off on that.
Okay, let's get
blah, blah, blah.
We're 19... already 5.5 minutes in.
Jeez, we're going to have to cut this out later on. Okay, so for those of you who have not listened to this before, the concept is we would bring up X amount of time in marathon history, and Kevin and I would then kind of freestyle and talk about our memories of that.
Yeah.
Now, as we learned in the last podcast, our memories of the Drexel North years, in which we spent like 3.5 hours talking about over two podcasts, those memories are tight and clean and voluminous. And
well, I think they're voluminous.
They are voluminous. Okay, maybe not tight.
Tight and clean.
Clean, relatively clean. Yeah. However, once we got into the Rife Center years, things got a little hazier.
Fooling around with my girlfriend at the marathon.
So. Oh, yeah.
Go on.
I remember that. I was sitting behind you, I think, when that happened.
Maybe you were.
Anyway, okay. If you ever corner me and ask me about the history of the Drexel North marathons, I can cite you chapter and verse of what went on, what year, which movies, blah, blah, blah. Mm. After that, though, it gets a little bit hazier in some ways. I personally did a little bit more prep this time. Not a ton, but enough that...
Yeah, we didn't want to disappoint you with too much prep.
No, because that would not be authentic. That would be too manufactured. And if there's one thing we don't do here, it's scripted and manufactured. We are 100% off the cuff.
That's right.
Raw. Unfiltered.
Right.
Something like that. Yes. So anyway, last time we did the Rife Center, and we had to cut off right when we were getting to the 1999 sci-fi marathon. So we're going to try something a little different this time.
Mm-hmm.
And this might mean that long term, we space out these podcasts a little bit longer. But today, we are only going to talk about 1999, which was a very pivotal year in marathon history on a lot of fronts. And I think we can come up with some good stories to tell about this. So,
of course.
Okay, on a personal note, let me set the background for you where I was in 1999.
I was born a poor black child.
I was slowly reforming my way out of that life of poverty at that point.
Yeah.
Those of you who listened to the last time or to the last podcast know I had worked for the Drexel from November 1995 until January 1998, had a three-month tour of duty at Studio 35, then went back to the Drexel Grandview to be the manager of the theater.
Ironically, locking heads with Charlie,
yeah,
the janitor.
Yeah. From April 1998 until end of January 1999. So, end of January 1999, I went back to work at Studio 35, and I would stay there until January 2003. So I'm working for Studio
into
at that,
the next century.
Yeah, working for Studio at that point. 1999 was a weird year for me because that was the first time I attended the Boston Science Fiction Marathon, the 24-hour Boston Science Fiction Marathon. That is the sister, the mother, the elder, whatever, of the Columbus Marathon.
The Elder Beast.
Elder Beast. So, some of my memories of Columbus sci-fi post-1999 get a bit odd because sometimes there is some overlap between Boston and Columbus in any given year.
Yeah.
Try to make that as clear as we can. But that's where I was as we enter spring of 1999. I'm working at Studio 35, and I'm sort of getting more and more behind the scenes of the marathon. So, some of the stories I'll be able to tell today will have a little more maybe insidery content, some of which you might not have heard before.
So this, you're going to talk, because I just attended this. At this point, I was not even anywhere behind the scenes. I was just a fan.
Yeah.
So I was just showing up at these.
Well, spring 1999, it became very clear that the sci-fi marathons were not going to continue at the Rife Center. For the reasons we spoke about last time, attendance was down for a lot of reasons, some of which was pre-publicity, some of which was lineup, some of which was the inability to bring food into the theater.
Scheduling, yeah.
You know, there were a lot of X factors that went into that. Plus, it became very difficult and onerous to rent the Rife Center, to rent the Capitol Theater. You had to rent the place. You had to rent it at a time when there weren't other things going on. You had to bring in the projection equipment. There were a lot of hoops to jump through. You have to remember, too, at that time, even though attendance had dropped, last sci-fi at the Rife Center was still around 350 to 400 people. Hmm. Enough that you couldn't just say,
that's
well,
a good amount.
Yeah, yeah, you couldn't just say, let's go to the Drexel, because the Drexel only had 300 seats. Even though
I remember, because I remember that was the big thing, is that would we move to the Drexel, but the Drexel, because by this time the Drexel had been split up, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Because it used to, how many seats did the Drexel used to have?
That I don't know, but
when it was all one theater in the 80s.
I had to believe around 500 to 600.
Okay. It was but big. It was a big room.
I was never in there when it was one theater.
You've never been? Oh, wow. It was a big room.
Never even seen a picture of it when it was one screen.
It was similarly wide and not as deep. It was just deeper, but I mean, it was almost square as opposed to the North being.
As I told you last time, I had pitched the idea of bringing the 24-hour horror marathon back to the Drexel Grandview when I managed the joint.
Yeah.
But Jeff Frank was not a big fan of that and didn't want to pursue that, in part because back then it was probably a little more difficult to just all of a sudden try to manipulate a marathon into the Drexel with the state of art house films at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There were still a lot of booming titles coming through, and it wasn't – I'm not saying that it's easy today – but it was a little bit harder just to make that excuse. And the audience was big enough that you still wanted to pursue a venue that had maybe 400 to 500 seats.
Yeah.
So, spring 1999 rolls around. And at the time, the venerable, up to that point, fairly famous Continent Theater, which had been a Lowe's Continent, and this now it was Sony's Continent at that time.
Okay, yeah.
You know, back in the day, for those of you who weren't alive back then, the Continent was a cutting edge concept in Columbus.
It was it had the largest, most number of screens at one point.
Yeah.
Started out with four, and then it went to seven, which trumped Westerville 6.
And having that theater in the Continent itself, which was apartment complex, shops, food court, and we're talking like this was the place to go for a while.
It was very trendy.
A good 10 years or so. This was the hip place to go in Columbus. You go up there today and you think, really? Because it's a ghost town.
The Funny Bone used to be right next door to the theater. Yeah, it was a big deal. I remember even as a kid going and seeing stuff like Superman 2. I remember when we saw Superman. I remember seeing Dragon Slayer.
Yeah.
Back from the early 80s. And we'd go see it at the theater, and then you'd walk through the... Was it called the French Quarter? It was designed after
the French Quarter, and it was like the French Market.
The French Market.
Yeah.
We'd have to walk through the apartment areas, but it looked like the French Quarter in New Orleans. And then you walk and they have a little mall that was, again, still kind of early for indoor malls.
Yes.
You know, it was still not, they didn't have one on every corner, and we go and get, we, you know, get food there.
And it was big. And like most really nice things in Columbus, it got screwed up.
Mm.
Because that's Columbus. Now I'm going to sound bitter, but... and that was around the time that Northland Mall was still really big. And that was not that far away from that. So you had that corridor, that northeast Dublin Road, Morse Road corridor was still kind of booming. And that changed over time, obviously. And now today, it's just like a weird ghost town. And the theater still operates, but it went very, very...
the screens, and it was sort of like the second run-ish movie theater
there was a small period of time where one of the guys that used to run the AMC Lennox took over the Continent and wanted to turn it into like a viable independent multiplex.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite work, and it's been passed around several times since then. I haven't been there since like 2006.
Yeah, it's been a while.
But yeah, at the time though, it wasn't at its peak by far, but it was still a fairly viable theater. But it was the only Sony theater in town, and business was down enough that the Drexel could rent out their main screen, which was about 400 seats or so, and hold the sci-fi marathon there that year. And I remember this was like a fairly big thing because...
It was a big theater because they used to have 70mm projection there, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a big thing because all of a sudden you can have food in the theater again.
Yeah.
And it's a multiplex, which was always the fear. Like if you do it in a multiplex, will it ruin the feel? But just being able to be in a theater where it felt more like the marathon.
And felt like a movie theater.
It felt like a movie theater. And the setup of the house was the setup of the Drexel North. The big row in the middle, the two small rows on the side. It even had a little bit of a Drexel Northy type feel in terms of the color design.
It was also narrow. So it wasn't, yeah, it felt like that. You know, football field theater.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
So, Sci-Fi Marathon was held there this year. Now, there, some of you will have accessed our good friend Mr. Zucchini's site, the Hall of Marathonia, and looked at the lineup. And some of you will have been going for a long time. And you might have the flyer, which I have right here. Because God knows I'm a freak for cheap Foley effects. Some of you will look at that flyer, and you'll notice on the front, it prominently features a huge graphic with a spiral, and it says Time Warp. And yeah. This was the Time Warp Marathon. And then you'll flip to the back, or you'll look at the webpage and say, wait a minute, there are like two time travel films.
Well, there's three. Terminator, Time Bandits, and Terminator 2.
Like, what is going on? Okay, I'm here to tell you, this might be the most official version yet of why this was a time travel marathon, yet not a time travel marathon.
Yes, this was so confusing.
Okay. So, my partner in crime, Bruce Bartu, the part two of the two-headed marathon beast that we are today, the godfather, the grandfather, the forefather of all Columbus marathons, the creator of this cinematic thing of ours that we do.
The Thriller in Manila.
The undisputed heavyweight champion of marathons in Columbus. He's going to hate me for saying that.
Wow.
So,
like he listens to this.
Wait,
he can make up crazy rumors about Bruce Bartu.
Who's that on the phone? Bruce. Uh-oh.
Bruce, oh no.
He knows. So for several years, he had wanted to do a time travel theme, which in some ways I think is kind of elementary. A lot of good time travel films in sci-fi, a lot of good variations on time travel. Interesting stuff. It was 1999. It was right before the millennium. Tons of stuff were, you know, made this a viable option. And he had been pitching this idea for a while because before time travel, the only other themes sci-fi had ever done were 50 years of the atomic bomb in 1995, the 500 years into the future in 1992, which was a playoff of the 1492 to 1992 500-year anniversary discovery of...
These are planned.
Yeah, themes. Planned themes.
Like,
yeah.
I remember the first, was it Sci-Fi 3? It was all about things falling from the sky.
Yeah, and there was...
So there was sort of these...
And there was this like,
connective tissue.
And there was the progression, I think, in Sci-Fi 1, where you had Dark Star and Alien and It, the Terror from Beyond Space, all of which are kind of in the same quasi-universe mold. But yeah, in terms of pre-planned themes where you advertise, this is a theme. He had wanted to do a time travel marathon for a long time. I remember some of the films he pitched were Terminator, Terminator 2, Time Bandits, which
did
all
ended
up on here.
Did you just say it like Arnold? Did you go Terminator?
Terminator 2. You can't kill me.
It's like Time Bandits in a British accent.
Time After Time, which actually is on the flyer for this. Some other titles he had, The Time Machine, the original with Rod Taylor.
Yeah.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Excellent.
Which would be, still is never shown. When we do the time travel marathon, the real one, we will have Bill and Ted, I promise. I'm going to hate,
who knows, by then
hate myself for saying that. Yeah.
The actors to come. If John Wick 2 doesn't clinch it at the box office.
Yeah.
I think we can get Alex Winter for like $50.
Probably could.
In like coffee. Yeah.
You hear that, Alex? We have
and a
coffee.
Massage from me.
Yeah, sure. What other films did he have on the list? Like Sleeper, Back to the Future, and this was
this was far enough into the time that it was a good 15 years since these movies. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Although Terminator 2, oddly enough, was only 8 years old at that point.
But still, that's
whoa. Yeah. So this was the original pitch, was to do majority of the lineup time travel films.
Yeah.
At the time, Jeff disagreed with the viability of showing some of these films.
Uh-oh.
Now, again, there's a lot of transitional aspects to this time of the marathon event.
I know. Jeff always liked the old sci-fi, like Day the Earth Stood
there's
Still.
There's that. He was also always a big proponent, some years more than others, some years to more of some years to less of a detriment or more of a detriment than others. He was always a big proponent for premieres.
Yeah.
Which I think is right in a lot of ways. I think ideally you should have at least two or three premiere type films in a lineup. And back then it was still, you could still get enough films, as this marathon proved, that people had not seen or weren't going to see until they came out as a mid-range to major release.
Well, and through the 90s it really developed into a premiering event as well. Because the premieres have done really well.
Yeah, and that's a way you keep up to date. Yeah. He, at the time, I'm sure, was looking at the attendance kind of dropping and thinking, well, how do we revitalize this? And he was probably thinking more along the lines of, let's get two or three good premieres, let's have two or three solid titles and try to fill in the rest.
Yeah.
He disagreed on some of these titles, you know, and in some ways, I guess this could make sense. I think it all comes down to just a difference in philosophy. Mm-hmm. To him, there were films like, say, Sleeper, where I believe at the time he argued that, well, is Sleeper really going to sell a lot of tickets on its own? Or Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, that was probably something where...
Neither was Invasion of the B-Girls,
no,
for that matter.
No, and yeah. I wouldn't be shocked if for something like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, if at the time, because of when it came out, he didn't view it as being as beloved as it was at that point.
Well, and also it's not... It's a comedy. It's not sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's a comedy. Now, it's never meant to be a sci-fi movie.
The counter-argument that could be made and was made, and I would make this today, is...
I already saw it at that theater with a date. And
well, like Sleeper.
Yeah.
On its own, Sleeper probably doesn't sell a ton of tickets. But as part of an entire cohesive lineup, that's what people are buying tickets for. The Time Machine, for instance.
You could now bill it as a pre-rape Woody Allen.
Yes, you could.
Yeah. Curious.
The Time Machine at the time, we had shown it at the Drexel Grandview in 1998 for the Kids Film Festival. Not a lot of people had shown up, and he was a little down on it because of that. Now,
Time Machine?
The Time Machine. Those are two totally different audiences at that point.
Well, it's not a kid's
movie. But as a result, this was the compromise you got into it. You have to understand, today, with sci-fi and horror, Bruce and I pretty much have free reign. This is going to be like the scene in Boogie Nights where Mark Wahlberg says, "Jack lets me direct my own scenes," and then Jack Horner's like, "I don't let him direct his own scenes." pretty much what you see today at Sci-Fi and Horror at the Drexel, they give us free reign to program what we want. I mean, it's great, and more credit to them. Sci-Fi, especially for a long time, was a very much collaborative effort between Jeff and Bruce, and you know, Jeff was still running the theater. So you'd get things like this where some years, you know, there'd maybe be a little more of one than the other, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And that's why for this year, Bruce very much was hot to trot to do a Time Warp one. And yet in the end, there were only three Time Warp films. And in fact, on the flyer, there were four.
Better that there be none.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was like Alien and Aliens. And instead of Time Bandit, you would have had, I don't know. Random.
Well, and
movie
I think
that didn't have time travel in it.
Maybe, yeah, I guess. I think that
Star Wars.
I think you saw this is a great example of what happens when you have two people collaborating on an event and they both are kind of going in slightly different ways.
Yeah.
Is this one. And we joke about it today. I joke about it with Bruce, like, hey, we should do a time travel marathon sometime that has, you know, more time travel films. That would be fun. We have talked about it a lot. And we've talked about it in public at Sci-Fi Marathon to do this. Now, the result you get, if you look at the original flyer for the event, is a lineup that seems really fun, and yet some of these films did not show up. For instance, on the original flyer, Time After Time is on there.
Mm-hmm.
Could not get a print of it back then.
Yeah.
Still can't get a print today. For some reason, Time After Time, there's no DCP. There's no print that we know of that's showable. There's a DVD, but it's like a real early DVD. It would look terrible, blown up on the big screen. And that's a film that would really play. I mean, that holds up in a lot of ways. Time After Time had to get canceled.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorites, Videodrome, which at that time had never played a sci-fi marathon before, is on the flyer, but they could not secure the print at the time, so that got cut. I think those are the only two on the flyer that didn't actually end up showing. But... to me, this lineup as a whole, this was, I think, one of my favorite post-Drexel North year lineups.
This is a great lineup.
Very solid top to bottom. Terminator, Kronos, that's K, Kronos with a K.
Is that the one with the giant capacitor thing?
Yeah, the that keeps multiplying.
Which they'd shown 10 years before.
Jeff Morrow and Barbara Lawrence do battle with a monster machine from outer space, growing gigantic as it absorbs all of our planet's supplies of energy. The conquering cube heads for Los Angeles, destroying everything in its path. A rarely seen treat from 1967 in glorious 35mm Regal scope.
57.
That was Bruce's copy from the flyer. So you've got the Terminator, you've got Kronos with a K, not the Guillermo del Toro Kronos with a C. Yeah. The Ohio premiere of Free Enterprise, Catwoman on the Moon in 3D, the Midwest premiere of David Cronenberg's Existenz, Mysterious Island, the re-release premiere of Mighty Peking Man.
The Ohio premiere.
Yeah.
Says Ohio premiere.
Invasion of the B-Girls, Dark City, Time Bandits, and Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Top to bottom, very solid lineup. And
part of what makes
in practice
it such
worked
a good,
really well.
Part of what makes this such a good lineup is it has classics that it has really good solid ones like Terminator, Terminator 2, and Dark City, which was less seen back then.
Yes. Dark City had just come out
the year
before.
It was an underseen movie.
Yeah.
But you also had classic 50s black and white stuff like Kronos and wasn't Mysterious Island. That was, well, that was probably in color, but
yeah.
But you had that kind of old school sci-fi, and then you had sort of grindhouse sci-fi with Invasion of the B-Girls. And it was a nice mix, and yes. you didn't get it heavy on any one area, which
this
is kind of cool.
Is a very good example of being able to have that ideal mix that you strive for in a marathon.
Yeah.
Existenz at the time, that premiere only came through a couple of days before.
Yeah.
And that was fairly,
I love
that was, yeah, that was,
I'm a huge fan.
Fairly
of
big in terms of where Cronenberg was at that time in his career.
Yeah.
In terms of a fairly hard sci-fi film that
yeah.
he was doing. It's weird because Existenz, you can read it as almost like a response and a quasi-remake of Videodrome. So even though Videodrome was dropped from the lineup, it is. I'm right.
Okay.
You're wrong, Kevin. Don't even try.
Sure. Although I do like Deborah Harry better than
I don't care who you like. Don't mess with Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Well, no, she's good too.
She'll cut
nothing
you.
Against her. Oh, yeah, she probably would. Although I get a port in her my back if she stuck her tongue in it.
Okay.
That was an awkward silence for anyone who didn't want to know. But this was also kind of like his... Did Cronenberg do anything after this that would fall in that level of heavy sci-fi horror or body... It was just mixed into body horror.
This is probably
as well.
The last time he did a film that
genre.
Really touched on genre like his previous films had.
Because then he started... Because he did what? The History of Violence? Just like 3 or 4 years later, right?
History of Violence, Spider with Ralph Fiennes... Mm-hmm. Yeah, he got into much different projects after that.
Yeah. And continues doing,
yeah,
you know, not in that original level.
But this was like major excitement when this came out. And you have to understand too, as we've talked about before, 1999, this is like a real turning point for a lot of culture along with the marathons. The internet is really picking up as a major force in American lives. You've got everything going on right before the millennium. 1999 is the year that Star Wars Phantom Menace is about to debut, which...
Like a month later.
Yeah, which beforehand, you know, the hype was so relentless about that. There's another movie that's about to debut not that long after this called The Matrix that ended up kind of changing a lot of what... Actually, was it right?
Never heard of it.
Was it... Yeah. I'm trying to think now. Was Matrix...
It was April.
The marathon?
It came out maybe right before. I think it came out like the week before this or right around that.
Yeah. Which completely changed how a lot of people viewed mainstream sci-fi.
Yeah.
It was very much a time where that burgeoning fan culture that has now taken over a lot of mainstream movies was really starting to gain its foothold. And the internet had a lot to do with that.
Well, and that's when like Ain't It Cool News was starting out.
Ain't It Cool was huge at that point.
Yeah.
So, and there was still the hope.
A new hope?
There was a new hope. Then it died. There was a hope that getting away from the Rife Center and having less restrictions would revitalize the attendance. I never got the full number for how many people came to this marathon.
Yeah.
I think it was right around what was at the Rife the year before, if not just a little bit less, but still fairly strong.
Yeah, I remember being a really good crowd.
Yeah. And, you know, you could feel a lot of that excitement that was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Not, even at the time, not knowing what would come next. And this would begin a time of like 3 or 4 years in a row where the marathon started globetrotting around to various and sundry places. This was the year I remember that following up going to the 1999 Boston Sci-Fi, my Ohio cohorts and I were anointed as the newest emissaries of the ML Ohio. Now, little backstory for this. Up in Boston, for years, they had various groups of attendees who would form their own little fan groups. Mm-hmm. So there were the asteroid farmers.
Terror cells.
Yeah. Okay. Let's soft pedal it a bit.
Okay.
For the purposes of this PG-rated podcast.
PG-rated. Did you hear how we started?
Ah!
What?
there were the asteroid farmers of Saturn or Venus. I forget which one. What? There were some other people. And famously, there was a small group that dubbed themselves the Martian Liberation Organization, or the MLO, a.k.a. the PLO. And they would dress up in boiler suits and berets, and they would come out and make demands.
Oh,
of,
you did this, didn't
I've
you?
Talked, yeah, I did
I've
this.
Seen, I, rem- yeah. I recall photographs in my brain of you running around looking a little bit like Che Guevara.
Just a bit, yeah.
The beard and everything.
Well, the famous MLO story is that back in 1986, when the Boston Marathon, this was Bruce's last one, Bruce's last Boston sci-fi he did while he was living up there. He came back to MC the next year's one after he moved to Columbus. Mm. But it was a Halley's Comet-themed marathon. Mm. And they didn't announce any of the films in advance. And there was a reason for that, for surprise, but also because, like three films in, Bruce says, oh, wait, there's a problem in the projection booth. Hang on for a second, I'll be right back. Walk back to the projection booth, and then they had prearranged slides up on the screen of him in the projection booth. He walks in, and the MLO is back there. And they take, like, a leaf blower and put it up to his head, and it's, like, brainwashing him because they, you know, gigged it to look like a big gray. And the MLO hijacked the marathon for, like, two, maybe three movies in a row, yeah. And they showed Mars movies, and they made demands, and they said, if our demands aren't met... you know, it was like take Nixon's name off of the moon, the plaque that's on there, and we want Mars bars to come back into circulation. And there was something else. And they said, if our
now I want a Mars bar.
If our demands aren't met, yeah. We will reduce this. We will reduce the Earth to a flaming cinder.
Mm.
And eventually, you know, order was restored. The Mars films.
It's a good
were
thing
stopped.
This happened before 9/11.
Because... Well, here's what's interesting though. This was 1986 in February.
Oh, my God.
The MLO's demands were not met.
Mm.
Not that long afterwards, the Orson Welles Cinema, the famous legendary art house, three-screen art house in Cambridge, where the Boston Sci-Fi Marathon held its first 11 events.
Yeah.
The Orson Welles Cinema one day had a fire in the popcorn machine, and there was enough asbestos and old things in the theater, it burned up the theater. And the Orson Welles was no more. So in some ways, the MLO's threat came true because the Orson Welles was reduced to a burning, flaming cinder.
They have the Martians have a beef with Orson Welles, though.
That is true.
You know,
that is true.
They have a right to be concerned.
Who's laughing now, Orson?
That's
huh?
right.
Yeah.
Fat bastard.
So the MLO continues, though.
Yeah.
And in 1997 at the Columbus Sci-Fi, the major himself, Tom Chanel, one of the great kind of spirit of the marathon type guys you'll ever meet. You never met Tom, but you and Tom would get along really well. Tom's kind of Tom and Kevin could be distant relatives in a lot of ways.
But I hate my family. I'm just going to continue.
Tom in 1997, you might know him because he personally accompanied the print of Gamera, Guardian of the Universe from screening at the Boston Museum of Art to Columbus. They actually bought a seat for the print, and Tom showed up and talked for a few minutes and gave Bruce the MLO key to the Boston Marathon.
Oh, wow.
So Tom kind of adopts us once we go up to Boston. And Tom says, okay, well, you guys are now the ML Ohio branch. You have to represent at Columbus.
Yes.
So Tom sends me the material for some of the badges. I go buy a black boiler suit.
You tell him you don't need no stinking badges?
Hey! Welcome to Outdated Jokes, everybody. Tom sends me the badges. Tom always wore a red boiler suit, so I went and bought a black one because I couldn't find a red one. Plus, it looked more badass that way. And I dressed up as the emissary for the MLO. Now, my friends at the time, I said, you guys should dress up with me. They're all like, wear a badge on maybe on my regular clothes.
I'll shave that day.
But I went full scale, and I got the outfit. I got the beret. I bought a bunch of Mars bars.
Was
and
it
passed-
a raspberry beret?
No. Yeah, stop. Stop. Will you stop?
Oh, my gosh.
To quote the great Gorilla Monsoon, will you stop it?
Barry.
Handed out Mars bars in line. I had one guy who was a long-term attendee who for half the marathon kept asking me, so you're really going to start an MLO chapter here? And I'm like, it was just a fun thing to do.
Wait, it was like, seriously, can
I
join?
Serious, yeah. I that was the only time I wore the boiler suit and did my Che Guevara act. So. Yeah. But
I don't think I got a Mars bar out of that, though.
No, I wasn't cool enough back then to not do that. Now, next podcast, you're now I'm way too cool to wear anything like that. Jack, give me a break, man. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, I wore that for the whole event. I'm trying to think some other memories of the time warp, of course. We're totally
burying
the lead here. Okay. Bruce's grand idea, because some of you will look at this and say, oh, it says the 17th annual Ohio 24-hour science fiction
and
marathon.
And what was it the year before?
The previous one was the 12th annual. What's going on with that?
What happened?
So Bruce, okay, here the official story is...
There's a Wikipedia alternate explanation.
I'm here to tell you the truth, Jack. Between 12 and 17, we time warped ahead. We did.
This is all just to save the title on the flyer.
Yeah, 13 through 16 all happened. Most of you don't remember it because of the elasticity of time travel. His idea was we should do a time warp marathon and time warp ahead, and then eventually go back and do the missing marathons.
So that was originally the plan.
That was the plan. And we did 15 eventually. And we did, I thought there was one more, I forget.
So there was 18th and the 19th, then the 20th, 21st,
15th,
then the 15th,
then the 23rd.
The 23rd.
So there's no SF22,
24, 25, 26. 27, and then it gets us all the way back to...
We kind of messed things up, and as a result, we confused the local press forever.
You guys can't count.
Because now they're like, I don't get it. This isn't the real one. we did. I remember I did get up at...
Well, you know what? Here's the thing, and I will say this, because I talk about the marathon all the time. Whenever I go in media, I try to. I try and talk. When I was on CD1025, I talk about it, whatever. I talk about it on 610. And... I would get that question of like, oh yeah, I remember. So wait, it was FS whatever. When did it start? And I'm like, well, and I just couldn't even answer because I mean, it's just the numbering never worked out.
I might make the argument that it was a fun idea and concept, but it's led to some confusion over the years. I don't know that that's hurt the event.
No,
it is.
I don't think
odd,
anyone's
though.
Like, this is bullshit. 17. I have to go to number 12. I'm going to wait a couple years.
I think at that marathon, I got up at one point in my MLO costume and I explained the demands of the MLO.
Yeah.
And I said, most of you don't remember, but at SF 13 or 14, I forget which one, we hijacked the marathon, we showed a bunch of Mars movies, and the reaction of the crowd was the following. This is an accurate recreation of how the crowd reacted to my little spiel.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, the kind of silence that only occurs in deep space.
It was a vacuum. It was, this guy, again, really?
Were you wearing your suit and your beret?
For the whole thing.
No wonder.
They were all like, this guy? Again? Really? Now, see, today, they're probably still saying that, but they're like, all right, this guy again.
This guy
is
insane.
All right.
He's eating flies and painting the wall with his feces again.
At least he shows up and talks a little bit. He's probably going to talk about falling in love with Blade Runner again.
Jeez.
Oh, God.
Suspiria.
Enough of this guy. Makes us all look bad.
Suspiria.
So, anyway, all right, some other memories of this event. Free Enterprise at the time went over like gangbusters.
That was a huge hit.
Yeah.
Huge hit.
I think that's a prototypical marathon premiere, and I say that because that film never got a major release. It is not that well remembered today in terms of like if you walk down the street and offer off something like to typical fans, say, oh, Existence, the Cronenberg film. I think a decent amount of people will say, oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah. And it's on Netflix.
The director barely remembers Free Enterprise.
Free Enterprise, yeah. It's very clever, and in the moment, it played like gangbusters to that audience, and people who were there will remember it.
Oh, yeah.
And that's not a bad thing. That
I ran into the director at Comic-Con in 2000, a couple years later.
Yeah.
And even he has trouble remembering. I mean, that's his biggest, at the time, I don't know if he wanted to do other things, but that was the biggest thing he could hang his hat on. And even then, at Comic-Con, nobody even really knew what it was.
And if you've never seen it, I mean, it's entertaining and it plays to an audience like that because it's all about guys who are huge into sci-fi and horror and fan culture, and they kind of have to try to strike that balance between being into that and having a real life.
Well, and they also, one of the big stars of it, they got William
Shatner was in it. And, yeah. and
oh, I thought you're trying to signal me. You're like, are you thinking? No, the whole thing is that William Shatner was in it. And this was at around the time that it was suddenly becoming popular to like Shatner.
Yes.
Again.
Yeah.
Because people don't remember this, especially if you're under 30. Shatner was huge in the 50s and 60s. He got bigger, bigger. And then he kind of became a has-been with Star Trek, being like, oh, he's a... And then he kind of just became fat and stupid, and nobody knew how to take him. And he had never taken himself seriously. And then it was by the time the 90s rolled through, people were realizing, oh, no, this guy just has a really good sense of humor about himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can go back and look at the stuff he did in the 70s and be like, oh, no, no, he knew exactly what he was doing. It's just nobody got it at the time.
Happens to us all. We all become fat and stupid eventually.
Yeah, some of us start fat and stupid.
Some of us start and just get fatter.
I may have and I stupider. May have found that line. I'm slouching into the couch.
Wasn't
right
Eric McCormick in Enterprise? Yeah.
Because it was right before he did Will and Grace. Yeah. I think he made the movie
and
before.
And there's that weird sex scene in the middle of it where it's like, I mean, it's not weird in terms of content, but it's a pretty chaste movie until he gets it on with the girl, and it's like, wow, this is like mildly.
The girl actually, she was my
she's
biggest,
hot too. Yeah.
She is my that's my big she is my biggest beef about that movie.
Yeah,
as much as I thought that movie was a hoot, there are two things I couldn't swallow. First of all, that somebody would be that into Star Trek and take Shatner seriously. So first of all, that had a little bit of. That a little bit of sticking power. But also the girl that he ends up falling, she's like supermodel type going through the comic book store. And I'm like, you know, like didn't take somebody like Lizzie Kaplan, somebody, you know, who's kind of geeky, but still totally gorgeous, who every geek wants to nail.
Yeah.
No, they went and they got like, Heidi Klum, basically. Yeah. And it's like, I don't buy Heidi Klum going through.
I personally know a few people listening to this that will get a huge laugh out of you mentioning Lizzie Kaplan for reasons that you don't know. I do too.
Oh God, why?
I just do.
No, I know why you she's Lizzie Kaplan.
It's a dumb in joke. It's purely for me. I just know a few people who I really find Lizzie Kaplan to be very fetching.
Oh yeah.
And they question why I do.
She's the less pixie dream girl version of Zooey Deschanel.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a fun film.
Lots of... Yeah, oh, no, it was great. I remember, you're right. It killed the marathon.
Yeah.
It was huge.
Here's a setup for
it.
It
had a great time slot.
Here's a setup that will not pay off for another couple podcasts.
Yeah.
I had never seen Catwoman of the Moon in 3D before. I remember Lance Carwile, and those of you who've been going to the marathons long enough know Lance... Used to be, Lance did local programming at what became WHO 53 and then UPN 53. I think Lance is in Indianapolis now working for the same company.
Wait, he did glasses.
Yeah, glasses.
I know him. Yeah.
Lance.
He used to do the t-shirt.
Yeah, he was the t-shirt guy. Lance still consults on the Kappa Summer movie series.
Yeah.
For the programming. But Lance was, for years, the t-shirt guy.
Yeah.
And I wish we could, if I had the money, I would just bribe Lance to come back to Columbus and sell t-shirts because Lance had the best delivery and pitch for the t-shirt sales. Lance had the perfect voice. Lance could, you know, unendingly just keep saying, official Night of the Living Drexel t-shirts available now. And and you wanted to buy a t-shirt from Lance because Lance just emitted, like, you know, smooth salesman.
T-shirt whisperer.
Lance, he was. Oh, yeah. Lance, if you're listening to this, please come back. Please. So Bruce and I don't have to run the t-shirt table. Lance, I remember I knew him at this point, and Lance says, oh, you haven't seen Catwoman of the Moon in 3D? Oh, you'll enjoy this. Now, the funny thing is, Bruce had bought a print of Catwoman of the Moon in 3D.
Yeah.
It's public domain at this point. Uh-huh. And it turned out to only be about, maybe an hour, and the movie's supposed to be about an hour and 20 or so. It was missing almost an entire reel.
I was about to say, I recall there being...
Missing some of the actual 3D effects that are real 3D effects.
I recall it not being a complete experience, we'll say.
It's still fun.
Hmm. Well, it's even funnier when stuff gets... With movies like that, it's kind of funnier when you have no idea what the hell's happening.
The incomplete Catwoman of the Moon in 3D will pay off eventually with one of my all-time favorite marathon experiences involving the exact same print of the exact same film. But we will talk about that when we get to that marathon, because that's a special little nugget in and of itself.
Wow.
Some other stuff that played at this marathon. Let's see. Memories. This is interesting. Mighty Peking Man was courtesy of Rolling Thunder, which, if you remember at the time, Rolling Thunder was Quentin Tarantino's attempt at a film reissue label, and he worked with Grindhouse Releasing and Cowboy Booking to do that. They're the ones who kind of handled the Beyond when that was re-released the year before. And Mighty Peking Man was supposed to be one of their next big re-releases. It never really made it to that level, and in fact, you don't see them do anything like that today.
Well, it might be King Man, because if I'm not mistaken, well, it was it a Hong Kong film?
Yeah.
Okay. It was Asian, but I'm assuming with Giant the name Peking Man, it would be.
There's that scene where you see that they've had the tiger and they've sewed the tiger's mouth shut, which is just
horrible. Well, but I also remember it like was because it had like a like an ape man was the Mighty Peking Man, right? Was he tall? Was he big?
He was tall.
Okay. But I mean, like Mighty Joe Young or King Kong tall, or just like a guy in a suit, believable.
I forget.
But I remember they also cast this incredible knockout, blonde white woman.
Yes,
and she like gets naked in it too.
Yes, yeah, you're right.
Which blew my mind. And there's a scene in there. This is one of the things that I remember the most. There's a scene. I forget who said. I'll attribute it to myself because I'm a genius. There's a scene where the Mighty Peking Man is looking at her changing.
And you said the Mighty Peking Man, right? Yeah.
I'm claiming that. I don't know who said it.
One of my friends said it,
actually. Was it one of your friends? Yeah. Shit. I couldn't.
Take that, plagiarist.
I said it.
You're kicked off the podcast. Next time, Joe talks with himself.
No,
what a huge surprise.
I couldn't remember who said it, because I was one of the people who originated rocks.
Yes, you were.
Way back when. I do know that.
You were. Some other things I remember about this were Invasion of the B-Girls, I think, is a lot of fun. And it just kind of,
I may have slept through that one.
Oh, it's, I would love to see that again. Dark City, somehow I experienced three marathons in a row between 1999 and 2000, that being Boston, Columbus, and then Cleveland, where they all played Dark City at the worst possible times. A movie that's all about people going to sleep.
Yeah.
And Boston played it last in 1999.
It's not an action movie. No. It's very gloomy.
Columbus third from last. Cleveland played it at like 4 in the morning. It wasn't until I had seen it at the Dollar Theater the year before and fallen asleep. It wasn't until I bought it on DVD in 2000 that I finally saw the whole damn movie all the way through.
Yeah.
Which I like. I that to me is a really fun movie of its kind.
Did you show the theatrical cut, or was it the, because I know that the DVD has the,
it was theatrical, yeah.
Okay, so it's the one with the narration.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because that's...
Now, one of the most legendary marathon stories comes out of this event, and you've heard this story many times, but here, once and for all, is the complete story of Terminator 2, upside down and backwards.
Judgment Day.
So the last film of the marathon is Terminator 2, after opening the marathon with Terminator. Mm. And for those of you...
So what you're saying is, this terminated the marathon, would you say?
C minus. Wow. Ding. Ouch. Bad. Back to the auditions with you.
I'll be back.
So Terminator 2 closes. The Sony Continent, as opposed to every theater that had held a marathon before, the Drexel North and then the Rife Center, this was the first time that one of the theaters had a platter projection system for the films.
Yeah.
Reel-to-reel projection system. You can play a film... you can play each reel individually as it plays. So mm-hmm. if there's a problem with one of the reels, you can just take the reel off, rewind it, you know, take it forward a bit, start it back up, and you're fine.
This is real interesting.
Yeah. But a platter system, you have to take, let's say Terminator 2 is probably 7 reels long. Mm-hmm. You have to splice all those reels together into one big reel.
You have to assemble the whole
thing. Yeah, which kind of looks like a big roll of tape. And
like on a platter.
Without getting too technical about it, once you start it, if there's something like a problem, like let's say the film breaks, you can fix it, but it takes a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And if there's a major problem in the middle, it can take quite a while to actually try to fix this because you have everything in one piece. And it's not as easy as taking one reel that you're playing on its own and fixing that. You have to take into consideration, like, oh, halfway through the film there's a problem, we still have the rest of the film behind that all in one piece, and it's just a big lump of film, essentially.
So basically it turns into that scene in the Muppet movie where the Swedish chef is
running
the projector.
You run the risk of that happening.
Yeah.
So we hit, I think it was reel 3.
It was when they break her out of jail.
Of Terminator 2, and it hits the reel change. And the film is upside down and backwards. And we're like, uh-oh. And we stop the film. Bruce comes in front of the audience and tells him a version of what I just told you and then says, look, we can fix this and play this reel in the right direction, but it's probably going to take a half hour or so to fix it.
Were you just an audience member at this time, or were you involved in the planning?
I was slowly becoming more involved in the planning. I was kind of like, let's say in Godfather terms, if Bruce was Michael Corleone, I was... Or maybe if Bruce was Vito, I was maybe...
You're
like,
Sofia Coppola's character.
Well, I was bigger than that. I was maybe getting into Tom Hagen territory, or Hagen territory at that point. Like if Tom Hagen had a son in Godfather, that would have been me. I was getting into the family.
Who was Fredo at this point? I don't know. Was going to get shot in the
me
boat.
Too much. Tim Burton.
Uh oh.
Them's fighting.
You're
words.
Now going to have to play Jason X.
I want to play Jason X. I've always been a proponent of that. More on that later. So I'm becoming more involved with the event than I was before.
Yeah,
I'm starting to get. I maybe grew.
So you're kind of behind the scenes at this, because I mean, I remember sitting in the audience.
Well, I had,
when it happened, people were like, "What?"
Yeah. So he said, "We can try to fix it and take a half hour out of your time, or we can just let it play upside down and backwards, and then the next reel hopefully will be okay." Which is what we did, and people had a blast on it.
Well, and from the audience perspective, yeah. This is how, because everyone saw it happens, and whenever something goes wrong, especially on something projected. There's a lag before things get turned off.
Yes.
So it starts running backwards, and people are like, what the hell? Because it's upside down backwards. People didn't know what the hell was going on. And then finally they stop it. And this was not uncommon. Nowadays you don't see that happen with real upside down because everything's digital.
It's digital, yeah.
But I've seen this happen. You see this. It's not people know what happened.
Yeah.
It's not, they're not totally confused.
Yeah.
Bruce comes on. You got to remember this is back, this is back at the time when the marathons would not end close to the time. So we were already
back in the time. Come on. Well, yeah, please.
Well, no, because the last one was actually really damn close, you know. Really, but this one, it was like 1 o'clock and so it was going to be late. And so it'd be different if this was the first movie.
Yes.
But it was the last one. I remember him saying it's going to take about 15 or 20 minutes to fix.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, and you could hear this sigh from the, he says, or we could just play it as it is. And it was almost like it felt, at least when I saw it, he threw that out there, not expecting people to go for it.
It was a great moment of solidarity.
Yeah. And everyone just cheered for it to go. And the best part about it was it probably happened at the best time. Because first of all, you got to remember Terminator 2 is 8 years old at this time. Probably everybody in that audience had seen it at least once.
Yes.
In the theater. So it wasn't, not that it wasn't special, but it wasn't going to ruin anything for anybody. And it was at the scene where they're breaking Sarah Connor out of the jail, sort of the hospital.
Yes.
And so so by this time, they've established who the T-1000 is. So you have all of the T-1000 effects running in reverse, which are hilarious.
Yes.
And that's what worked. If it happened, if it was like the first reel, it wouldn't have been as impressive.
Very true.
It just happened to be the perfect time. And it was all action. So you missed no story, but it was brilliant and hilarious. And I remember having a blast watching it.
It was great. And it, again, as a moment of audience solidarity.
Yeah.
It kind of brought everybody together and gave them, in some ways, an additional bump at the end of the event and a little bit of energy that they might not have had.
Yeah.
So,
and it was only one reel. It turned out it was only, and it would have sucked if it suddenly just kept going.
And it began this tradition that has continued to today, where at every sci-fi marathon and a few horrors in between there, Bruce will play something upside down and backwards
called in
tribute.
Retrograde Progression.
Retrograde Projection, as Dave Zucchini has dubbed it.
Say that with such... I forgot that's what he said.
And if you look on the Hall of Marathonia, Dave will always put down what was played upside down and backwards. Yeah. And a lot of times it'll be a wry commentary. So it'll be, oh, here's a remake of a beloved film. So we'll play the trailer upside down and backwards of the remake, just to kind of razz it. Although there have been other times where it's played in oddly delightful ways, like Space Boy once played upside down and backwards.
It honestly made as much sense.
Yes. So that is the story of Terminator 2 upside down and backwards. And I think the feeling coming out of this marathon was that things were beginning to right themselves.
Yeah.
How little we knew.
After 2 years of them rifling
themselves. No. Yeah, it was. There was a really good feeling coming out of this one. And I remember one of the last things I said to Jeff Frank, he gave me a one of those lenticular, what do you call them? The lenticular souvenirs of a film where you rotate it and the picture moves because
a little hologram thing?
Little not like kind of quasi hologram
well
thing.
But they were lined
yeah.
It was a hologram.
Give me one of those from The Matrix, and then I said
I've got one of those.
You remember where it's Keanu swinging through the building?
No, I think I have one of him putting on his glasses. I think mine's a little different, but yeah,
I remember he gave me one of those, and then he said, well, call me about the horror marathon, because we were still planning on doing the third Shocktoberfest that fall, which would be called Son of Shocktoberfest, which was named by one of the audience members. Shocktoberfest number 2, Bride of Shocktoberfest. I had a dumb little contest where I said, you, the audience members, can vote on what the third Shocktoberfest will be named. And then I chose the most obvious one, which was Son of Shocktoberfest.
I thought I named that.
No.
No, I submitted it. No, I submitted it, and you did.
Well, it was you and like several other people.
Yeah, other people. Yeah. I mean, because it made sense, because it was Shocktoberfest Bride.
I don't know why I had the contest when I was just going to say, it's the easiest one. The
but no, I remember submitting that in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's all about you, Kevin.
Well, I remember it.
Yeah.
I respected you then.
Thank you. I know.
That
stopped a long time ago.
Yeah. Now, are we going to talk? I just out of curiosity, and this may be for a different time. Maybe this is for the next one. But are you going to explain why this never returned to the continent, or do we explain that in the next one?
We can probably cover it in the next one. Okay. Everything I always knew is that...
Well, if we're going to cover it, we'll cover
it. Yeah, we'll cover it next time. Okay. Yeah.
I just didn't know if it was something that at the end of this it's worth talking about, or for the next one. I was like, oh, we went to a different venue.
As far as I know, there was nothing nefarious.
Okay.
It was just how things worked out. But we'll talk more about that next time. So anyway, I'm hot to trot to continue the all-night horror marathon at the Drexel Grandview, even though I'm working at Studio 35 at this point. It was kind of odd in some ways because I'm working for what was in kind of competition, although I don't think Studio and Drexel were ever really competition back then. It was two completely different animals. But during that summer, I start planning out ideas for doing the third Shocktoberfest at the Drexel.
Hmm.
And I remember like August 99, I faxed all my ideas to Jeff at the Drexel. And I pretty much had like 6 films, maybe 7, that I was really looking at that I thought would be strong. And then through September, I didn't hear a lot from him. September, Jeff used to go to the Toronto Film Festival all the time, and that cut a week or two out of his schedule.
Yeah.
And things just kind of kept hanging on there, and I'm trying to plan as much as I can, but I'm not hearing anything from him. And finally, I remember that day when I get the phone call from him. This is like right at the beginning of October. And he says, Joe, do you want to just start planning for next year? Because I don't know that I can pull anything together this year.
Ooh.
And
when was this again?
1999.
No. What time of year?
Beginning of October.
Oh, God.
Late. Yeah. And we were planning on doing it like third weekend of October.
Yeah.
I'm a little mildly distraught at this point. Well, maybe not distraught, but really disappointed, because I was like, we can't do it.
Sitting in your bed naked, clinging and weeping into a pillow.
That too, yeah. We'd built enough momentum with the previous one that I didn't want to just give it up.
Yeah.
So
well,
I said,
in this town, man, you miss it a year and it kills you.
It can do a lot of bad things to you. So I said, okay, because he's not going to do anything at that point. I can't force him to. I then go back to my boss at Studio 35, the great John Conti, who was like, I've said it to him before, I've said it again, probably the best boss I ever had at a job. Boss as in the guy running the whole show.
Yeah.
John's a great guy.
I went to John and I said, hey, I'm not going to do this all-nighter with the Drexel anymore. What would you think about doing a full 24-hour horror marathon? And this was my dream at this point. This was like above many things in life at this point. This was my dream to resurrect the 24-hour horror marathon and to make it something again, because I was so distraught from when it was canceled before.
Yeah.
And John said, yeah, let's do it. We'll figure it out. You give me the list of movies to look into. I think we can make this work.
Yeah.
I was ecstatic. I can't tell you how ecstatic I was that this was the realization of my dream finally come true.
Yeah.
And I remember the phone call I made to my friend Steve Carter that day. First guy I called, and I'm like, Steve, it's back. The marathon's back. This is so fucking awesome. And The one big caveat I had with this, and looking back, I think this was a major mistake on this, my part, and proof that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew. Beginning of October is when we confirmed this.
Yeah.
I said to John, hey, we need at least 5-6 weeks to promote this. Let's do it November 14th and 15th.
Yeah.
Okay. Now,
Turkey Day.
When you do a horror marathon in anywhere, you want to try to do it in October if you can. Maybe a little bit earlier.
Makes sense.
You don't really want to do a horror marathon the week before Thanksgiving, because that's a little late in the year, to say the least.
Well, people have burned out from horror, yeah.
Just a bit. Yeah. But in my mind, I thought, we need as much time as we can to promote it because we haven't done it here before, blah, blah, blah. I can see that. I still don't think it was a great idea. I think we could have done it end of October.
Well, I guess the question also would have been how with the print availability, because how many people, I mean, in terms of getting those back
That was
then.
Part of the consideration, too, was not knowing. You know, it's hard enough to book prints back then a month in advance, let alone several weeks in advance.
But and it wasn't in the days where you could just get a video, you can get a Blu-ray and rip it like you can now.
Yeah.
If a push came to shove.
That being said, with all of that going on, I was still wildly excited, and I was getting my first opportunity to program whatever the hell I wanted.
Yeah.
And looking at the lineup now, looking at the flyer for the lineup, some of the titles sprung out that I knew, okay, we want to book this. I remember the first, I believe, four films we booked were The Vampire Lovers, Hammer Film, the first R-rated Hammer film. Because that, to me, showed at the first ever Night of the Living Drexel, hadn't shown since, and I wanted some continuity to show something again that showed back then. Because so much of this back then was me paying tribute to what Bruce did.
Yeah.
And me trying to resurrect the concept of what Bruce did.
Yeah.
Vampire Lovers, we had Vincent Price in The Conqueror Worm.
Mm-hmm.
We had, which, I granted, I booked because I had the art for it. That seems backwards, but that happens more often than you think.
Wow.
William Castle's Homicidal. Which we had.
It was a lot of fun. A lot of people. I don't think a lot of people had seen Homicide on that show.
I had never seen it before we showed it.
People, you see William Castle, you think 13 Ghosts, you think House on Haunted Hill,
yeah.
The Tingler. You got all those, but Homicidal is lesser known.
And of course, the one film that I knew, no matter what, come hell or high water, we were going to book because I'd never seen it on film before. Ding, 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 ding. Suspiria. Which continued the run of showings of that where people say, oh, everybody hates it.
You know what? I've heard that the only thing more terrifying than
the last 12 minutes of Suspiria are the first 92.
Yeah.
I've heard that too.
Somewhere. Somebody said that to me once.
There is an alternate cut somewhere that's 104 minutes.
Do you know what they did say to me as well? Suspiria.
Bula Bula. So we had those films Tora booked, Bora. And then we filled out the lineup. So the lineup in total.
Yeah.
At the event itself, you had The Silence of the Lambs, Homicidal, yes. Mr. Vampire, The Conqueror Worm, Tales from the Crypt, which we'll talk about in a minute, Dead Alive, Rocky Horror Picture Show, more on that in a minute, Suspiria, Phantasm, Creepshow, The Vampire Lovers, and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Okay, some notes on that.
Yeah.
On the flyer we had, They Came From Within, which at the time was incredibly hard to get for one reason or another.
Or what's it called? Is it Shivers?
Shivers was the original title, yeah.
Which is what it is, and the reason I want to point that out is if anyone like goes on Netflix or whatever, it's always under Shivers.
Yes, yeah.
It's usually,
It Came
listed.
From Within was the American title that was kind of picked on by.
Because I watched it, it was on New Year's. It was going off the Netflix service on like New Year's Day, so
yes.
I watched it on New Year's Eve. It's my parent, my family's
That's an
coming
awesome
over.
New Year's Eve movie, right?
And they're
there.
Like, yeah, my son Ben was watching it with me. It's a little odd.
Welcome to Sexual Parasite New Year's Eve.
Well, you know.
Yes.
There's worse ways to go.
Well, as you know, this guy right here, huge David Cronenberg fan, and They Came From Within at that time was really viewed as like right up there with Videodrome as a big masterpiece.
Yeah.
So we put the film on the flyer, and I made this long description. God, I'm reading this description right now. David Cronenberg's first commercial feature sets the stage for the disturbing themes explored in his later work, Not for the Weak of Heart, blah, blah, blah. Well, we hadn't had it confirmed.
Blah, blah, blah.
And we couldn't figure out where to get it, and we couldn't get any inroads, so we did not end up showing that.
No.
We had Blood Feast, the Herschel Gordon Lewis film, booked. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Herschel Gordon Lewis was still undergoing a career renaissance because of the efforts of Mike Vraney in Something Weird Video. Rest in peace. And an H.G. Lewis film had never shown at a marathon before, and were only beginning to come out on legit video. Unfortunately, in the week leading up to the marathon, our good friends Johnny Legend and Jimmy Maslin in Los Angeles went to procure their print from the warehouse, and it was missing a reel.
Yeah.
So we never ended up getting that as a result. The rest of the things on the flyer played. What we ended up replacing the Came From Within and Blood Feast with, first we had, we had Dead Alive. We were able to get that at the last minute. We figured, oh, that's always a fun one. It's a perennial, you know, people dig it. And back then people were still really wild for Dead Alive.
What, is that the only the second time it showed?
Yeah. Okay. After 1992.
I remember I had a friend of mine who I talked into going. He was a guy who was this this year? Must have been. I had met him and he was a cinematographer. And I took him to this and he was watching it and it was, he couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Just how insane the movie was.
Yeah. And still to this day, I mean, it's a great little piece of business.
Yeah.
So we had that. One of our local collector friends had an extensive 16 millimeter, an extension of a 16, hello, had an extension. Extensive 16 millimeter collection. Mm. So he offered us Phantasm, which we ended up showing right after Suspiria. Boy, that's a middle of the night feature for you. Suspiria and Phantasm back to back.
Yeah, hey. Wake up on that one.
And oddly enough, we ended up showing Suspiria and Phantasm again in 2013 at the fifth shock around the clock.
Suspiria.
Tales from the Crypt popped up because we gave the audience some options. We let them vote on what they'd like to see between Tales from the Crypt, that's the 1972 Tales from the Crypt, Carrie,
or them,
and one other. I forget what the third was, but they voted overwhelmingly for Tales from the Crypt, so we showed
them. It says, according to Dave's post, it says Tales from the Crypt won out by a narrow margin over Carrie.
I don't know. Maybe that might not be true.
Oh my gosh, you're accusing him of lying.
David Zucchini is a liar.
Have you no shame?
I don't even know him.
Shame, shame.
So Tales from the Crypt showed. So that's how that made it into the lineup. Mm-hmm. Rocky Horror Picture Show. Here's the story for Rocky Horror, why it ended up in the lineup. In my head at that point, we are an unproven commodity. We are a theater that has never run a marathon, let alone a 24-hour marathon before.
Yeah.
And I am looking for every kind of special attraction we can get to try to draw people in.
Yeah.
In late 1997, Graceland Cinema, which had been the home of Rocky Horror since the 70s, closed.
Actually, it had been in the Guinness book.
Yes.
It was in Guinness, actually, at one point.
Graceland closed. Mm-hmm. Rocky was without a home for a short bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to Southland Mall for a bit, and then Southland Mall closed, so they were without a home again.
Yeah.
Through one of my friends, I knew some of the people on the cast because they worked with said friend at their place of employment.
Yeah.
And I knew there was a connection with them. I reached out to one of those people I knew and said, hey, what would you guys think if we brought back Rocky Horror to Studio 35 for this horror marathon, one time only, we did it at midnight, and you guys could do the full Rocky Horror cast experience, kind of like dropping a Rocky Horror cast, shadow cast show into the middle of the marathon.
Yeah.
They were absolutely all about it.
Yeah.
And so they were able to put on their show.
Fishnet Mafia
This is the fish. What became the Fishnet Mafia?
Okay.
And inadvertently, several months later, I ended up kind of paving the way for Rocky to come to studio.
Yeah.
And I paid for my sins by working at the Rocky, working Rocky for like the next 2.5 years every other Saturday. This is sounding like me saying I'm the one who brought Rocky Horror to Studio 35 because of me.
Screw you, Richard O'Brien. All you did was make the play in the movie.
But this
musical
was the screening that kind of paved the way. And I remember we ended up, for the first and I think only time in Columbus Marathon history, we ended up prorating this event in part so if people wanted to come see Rocky Horror alone,
oh, really?
They'd only be paying like $10.
Okay.
They wouldn't have to pay the entire marathon ticket price.
Yeah.
I think it's the only time in marathon history in Columbus we've done a prorated option. Now, what you have to understand is I think this lineup in a lot of ways is pretty great. In a lot of ways, it's very much the product of 1999 me.
Yeah.
Because there
it was
are,
very ambitious.
Yeah.
And throwing in Rocky Horror is what kind of put it over the edge on that.
In a lot of ways, yeah. It's I had this image in my mind for a long time of this being kind of this being a lineup that was not one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But now that I look back and I remember back to 1999, I think, wow, this was me trying to do an all-killer, no-filler lineup.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways that succeeds. Problems were the date, obviously, mid-November, and the fact that Studio had never done a marathon before. And any time in this town you change venues like that or change companies, it's going to be a little harder to try to get the word out.
Yeah.
So in the weeks leading up to the marathon, ticket sales are okay at best. And going into the day of, we're only at about 150, 160 tickets sold.
Yeah.
Which is a little demoralizing to me because here's what I'm thinking. Well, number one, I'm sick. In the days before the marathon, I come down.
Well, we knew that.
Yeah, but physically sick. I come down with a sinus infection in the days before the marathon. This was back when I used to get terrible sinus infections.
Idiot.
And I'm looking ahead. It's like, I feel like shit. And the attendance for this thing that I've worked on, that I've tried to really promote, my dream, the attendance is lacking. Mm. And I feel depressed because I'm thinking, this is going to be a failure.
Yeah.
I'm going to go into this. We're going to do it. I'm going to be sick. And then in the end, we're not going to do it again. And I will have fucked up my one chance to realize my dream.
Wow.
But we soldier on, got to meet a few of the decoration people that still help out with decorations today, including the great effluvient, is that the right word? Maybe let's take that word out.
The great
benevolent Todd Babbert, who worked at UPN 53 at the time and continues to be like one of our compadres in crime to this day. Todd, if you ever came into Studio 35, was the one who would make the little trailer reels on video that we'd play at the concession stand. We'd always have a little TV up and play a loop of those. Todd always did that stuff gratis. One of the truly good guys in marathon history that doesn't quite get the credit he should. My old friend Rose from high school came in and started working on decorations full-time that year. Going into the day of the event, we come in and we pulled it off. I mean, it happened. But I remember in the beginning, we only had like about 150 sold, maybe 110 people showed up in the beginning.
Yeah.
When you look at the video of the event, it looks sparse in the beginning of the number of people that are actually there.
Because the theater seats 230?
At the time, it was like 300 and...
Oh, really?
340, I think. It looks...
At Studio?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
we used to sell 350 for when we sold out for horror. Theater looks a little... not that full. We tried to do this skit in the beginning because I wanted to put more showmanship into it. So I had this weird skit. I got on this kick of satirizing pretentious film culture. So I said, I got...
I know.
Yeah, I know.
Way to go, man.
How things have changed.
Yeah.
Someone will laugh out there. They'll say, what about the strange color of your body's tears, you twit? Here's the original intent of what I set up.
Mm.
I had several of my old friends from the Drexel help me out at the... running the ticket booth and some other things.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, here's what we're going to do. One of the girls who, or one of the ladies, I should say, who worked the ticket booth, her boyfriend was there with her. And I said, hey, boyfriend, guy who we called Orange. His name was Chris, but he had reddish orange hair, so he was always the orange to us. I said, Orange, here's what you're going to do.
The Orange.
Yeah. Orange.
Sounds
orange.
Like a really bad villain in a Marvel comic.
Well, yeah, there's more to say on that. But anyway. I said, Orange, here's what you're going to do. You're going to get in front of the audience when we start this all up, and you're going to go up with my friend Dave. And Dave, you've seen him before. He's the guy who won the costume contest at Horror as the Great God Pan. He won the costume contest at Horror the year before
Bastard.
As the bagpipe playing gorilla.
Bastard.
Dave has like a long beard and braids and like a mohawk on top. But I said, you and Dave are going to get up and put like sports jackets on, like dinner jackets, if you will.
Oh, okay.
And you're going to get up.
It's that kind of event.
Yeah, you're going to get up. Well, you're going to get up and say, hello and welcome to the Studio 35 Film Archive. And I had the two girls taking tickets when people came in say, hi, welcome to the Studio 35 Film Archive. And they
I do remember that.
And they wore dresses. Yeah, and it was supposed to be being
they
like
wore
this,
dresses.
It was supposed
That's
to, yeah.
Any dress will do. Just dresses. It was making a skirt.
I was trying to make it look like we were making this. I don't know what the hell I was thinking at the time because it's Studio 35.
You were a bundle
like
of creative energy back then, weren't you?
I've fallen so far down since then. So Chris and Dave get up there. The Orange and Dave get up there. And they're talking about how it's the film archive. And I just said to Orange, hey, riff for a while on, like, be really pretentious and annoying. Make the crowd turn on you, essentially. And he kind of did, although there's not enough of a crowd to really get a huge reaction. And then Dave, as he's talking, looks around. And Dave has gigged a large foam rubber severed leg right up on the stage, right out of sight of the audience. Dave picks that up and batters the Orange over the head with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two girls come by and they have to drag Orange out and they say, we need another host. What are we going to do? And at this point, because Silence of the Lambs was our first film we were showing,
yeah.
I had two of my friends come in cop outfits and wheel me in on
stretcher?
On a dolly with a quasi Hannibal Lecter getup.
I do remember that. I was cheap
and hadn't actually gone out to buy the mask, so I just had something tied around my face. And I was trying to do a quasi Hannibal Lecter / Tired Joe Neff gag, because I think the first thing I said was, I swore I'd never do this again.
Yeah.
And my demeanor as a host at that marathon was probably a little less energetic because I was really sick and a little depressed about the general state of attendance. But we soldiered on anyway. I did that. We began the marathon. But throughout the entire thing, I'm thinking, God, people are having fun, but you know what? This will be my one and only shot. I remember I ended up sleeping through Dead Alive in this little side closet at Studio 35.
Side closet.
Well, because I was exhausted at that point, and I really wanted to see Suspiria.
Suspiria.
We did Rocky Horror. It went off fairly well. The costume contest beforehand had like three entrants
in it. Did you ever end up in the Rocky Horror shadow cast yourself?
No.
Not as Jiminy Gravany or
no,
Big Sister?
No. They had a few people who wanted me to be Rocky at one point, but I begged off. don't ask me.
I would have paid for that.
Yeah.
I would have totally seen. I mean, if anything.
Just let the uncomfortable
magenta
silence
is what I would go for. That's
yeah.
You, yeah.
Costume contest, we had three entrants.
Or the, Little Nell. You
those were, that. Yeah. Who were the three entrants for the costume contest were one guy dressed up as Mankind, the Mick Foley, the WWF wrestler at the time. Someone as something else. And the winners were our pals, Jeff and Jeremy Glass, the infamous Glass brothers who always aced the costume contests. They dressed up as Santa Claus and a little boy who seemed to be a bit touched, if you will, who Santa gave a plastic bag to put on his head.
Nice.
He won, or they won.
And then he died.
And then he died.
A plastic bag on his head. Shit.
but anyway, I mean, you know, this, and we did the Coward's Corner for Homicidal. We actually,
I remember that.
We stretched
that
yellow tape on the floor up from the theater, up through the lobby to a little place. There were a lot of, I think this marathon I look back at, and if the attendance had been bigger, I think some of the creative bullshit that I had and that we had would have come across a little bit more prominently.
Yeah.
But because attendance was somewhat down, it seemed weird in the moment. Now, once we hit Rocky Horror, we got an infusion of about 60 more people.
Yeah.
And I think at total, at like the peak of the event, we had about 250 people total.
That's not bad. That's not bad. That's actually great.
If you look at the video for when Rocky was going on, the theater looks pretty full.
What was the last? You said it was been 2 years since Rocky Horror played, so you had a...
About a year or so, okay. Actually, between when Southland Mall played it and when we played it. When you look at the video of Rocky for this marathon, it's weird because there's a lot of Rocky people and there's a lot of marathon attendees who are like, what the fuck is this? I thought I stopped doing this 20 years ago. But Rocky was still had a lot of cultural cash at that point, and there was a real power in Columbus to bringing back Rocky as part of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of this is a blur to me, again, because I was so sick and coughing up green gunk all weekend. And I'm young, and I'm kind of dumb at this point. And again, I the whole time I'm thinking, countdown till the end of the marathon when I find out I'm never doing this again. But I try to have as much fun as I can. Yeah. This was the first time I had ever seen Suspiria in a theater, which was a total knockout experience. I love that. Yeah. We'll get more back to that when we get to 2013, like in 5 years.
Yeah.
Mr. Vampire was a pretty big hit. This was at the beginning of that resurgence of Hong Kong horror.
Okay, that was a
Hong America.
Kong. Yeah,
that was a hopping vampire film.
Wait, everything was a hopping vampire.
Well, that was like the first hopping vampire
film.
Oh,
no,
it
was hopping ghost story.
Chinese ghost story. Was hopping. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Silence of the Lambs had never played a marathon before, has not played a marathon since.
It was a good way to start.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's classy.
I floated the idea out on Facebook about a week or two ago when Hannibal received the cancellation notice. Mm. I floated the possibility of maybe showing one of the Hannibal Lecter films again at this year's horror marathon.
Don't just say one of the Hannibal, because...
I think I
show Red Dragon.
I mentioned between like Manhunter and Silence of the Lambs, and Silence of the Lambs seemed to get the most support.
Manhunter's poop.
Well, we'll save that discussion for another time. I'll say what some of my former
I love Brian.
What some
Cox,
of my what some
a
of my former students used to say. Man. Well, everybody has their opinion, don't they?
Wait a second. Did you just channel Cooter?
No, that was one of my former students.
That was
when I was a teacher.
Did he talk like that?
That was supposed to be like this.
Gology?
Yeah, no, don't. That.
Gology, anyway. Roscoe, I don't know if we can get Boss Hogg to do that for us. I'm going to put the Confederate flag on this.
Boy, you're not dating this podcast at all.
Well,
right
if I don't,
now, yeah.
Nobody else will.
Christ,
do.
Ugh. Anyway, Silence of the Lambs played pretty well. Everything played pretty well. It's just there was a much, much smaller crowd as part of this. But that being said, we made it. For me, this was a big accomplishment because I at least got to do it. It's one of those things where you say, well, damn it, if it's going to fail, at least...
Or damn it, Janet.
I'm going to go down swinging. I'm going to actually have said, I did it. We made it through the whole thing. And I remember the two big validating moments near the end of this marathon were, number one, Bruce stopped by because I borrowed a decent amount of his trailers to play before the films.
Bruce stopped by to pick something up, not to support you.
He stopped by near the end and was there for about a film or so and talked with John and I. And this was before Bruce and I became full partners in crime, but we were headed there. This was the relationship was...
Your Ernie and Bert history was...
We hadn't quite gotten to third
solidified.
Base yet, but we were all on our way there. Bruce and I talked for a minute, and you know, he shook my hand and said, good job.
Cool.
This was good. And that for me was like enough validation, because to me, especially at that time, I was like, I'm just trying to pick up what you had to drop for various reasons and continue on with it.
Well, I will say this, and this is taken again. I really didn't know you very well then, or even at all. So taken completely as an outsider and just as a just sheer audience member moment. I have to say, I do not recall any big gaffes in this.
No.
I thought it ran smoothly.
Yes.
I thought it was a good lineup. And having seen the inner workings of these a little bit, you know, like the sausage factory that is the marathons, it's sort of like a film. People talk about movies. There's a monumental amount of effort that it takes to make a bad movie.
Yes.
To even just make a movie. Coherent or not, takes a lot of work.
This is very, very true.
And so when you get a good movie made, that's even more impressive. And so the point being is that this wasn't just this was good. So you didn't just do a shitty marathon, you did a good marathon.
Yeah, I think
that was your first time out. So that was pretty impressive.
If we had done this lineup, say 2 years after, with maybe a guest of some sort, this would be something people would still talk about, like, oh, that was a kick-ass marathon.
Yeah.
And the people that were there really enjoyed it. And yeah, there weren't any big problems or anything. It was fine. The second valedictory moment was at the end when John Conti came up to me and said, well, we probably lost about $500 on this, but there was enough of a bump and the liquor sales were good and the PR was good enough. We should do this again next year.
Oh, wow.
And we should keep it going. And that, to me, kind of lifted my spirits because I thought, okay, it wasn't all in vain. It wasn't. Yeah, and you know how hard it is to go.
And this was the first place that sold liquor, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I should talk about
that.
I had a great amount of trepidation about liquor and the marathon, because you have to remember, up to that point, the horror marathon was the one that had the reputation as having all the rowdy kids and rowdy people in general, and was problematic in some ways because of just, it's horror.
It's
a different vibe.
Except that I will remind once again that it was the sci-fi marathon that the can got through.
That's very true.
I always have to remind.
But horror had like the drinking fountain in the back of the Drexel North torn down.
It was a different crowd.
It's horror. I mean, right. Even to today, there's a way different energy for the horror crowd than the sci-fi crowd.
Oh yeah. It's energy, but it's also, I think it, I don't know if it's as much, if it's truth versus perception, because you see the crowd of the, and everyone's in black and you got, you know, so it looks scary. It's a scary looking crowd, but a lot of them are really cool.
Well, this was what was interesting. Up to that point, horror crowd had more problems historically than the sci-fi crowd.
Yeah.
I, as a result, had a lot of trepidation about doing a marathon, a 24-hour at a place that sold beer.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh shit,
this is going to lead to
just a lot of drunken people.
Well, I remember calling a friend of mine when because he used to go to the marathons with me, and I called him and I said, yeah, they're doing it. They're doing it at the studio so they can serve beer. And he's like, I don't know if that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
But oddly enough, talk about turning points in marathon history. The complete opposite happened. For one, people that drank tended to just get really mellow and fall asleep.
Yeah.
But two, and I don't know exactly how this happened, and there have been many theories over the years.
Yeah.
A few of my friends say it's because of me and because I set a tone for this. I don't know if that's really true. I think it just kind of happens. But somehow at this point, the Horror Marathon crowd became extraordinarily well-behaved.
Wow.
Over the years, in fact, I would put my money on this, that we have had far less incidents of annoyance with the horror crowd since we started at Studio than the sci-fi crowd. Not that the sci-fi crowd has been a bunch of flaming assholes or anything.
No.
But there's been more problems with people talking at sci-fi. I mean, in like notable talking, not like little pockets here and there, because you run into this sometimes.
Yeah.
But stuff like... like people talking at sci-fi and the whole crowd is like, shut up.
Yeah.
When the drink throwing incident happened at Horror last year,
yeah.
That was kind of a big shock because that didn't happen at Horror.
It's the first time anything
first time
really
in
like
decades
that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Horror Marathon crowd, in fact, almost became polite in a way.
Yeah. Well, and I think that goes to that perception versus reality. Is that and you get that because if you're going to the sci-fi tends to be a little more accessible to the mainstream.
Yeah.
And I think that you gain more main, and nothing wrong with people in the mainstream, but you don't have the, I think you get a larger fan base at a horror marathon. And even though, like I said, it's a scary looking crowd, if you're, you know, this, you know, woman on her way to church and look at all these people coming out, you know, they freak out at all but everyone's there to see the movies.
Yes.
People aren't there to goof off.
And I think,
and it's, which is why it's funny. It's a little tease ahead. When you guys showed the Serbian film, I remember waiting in line to see it, and people were talking about, have you seen it? I had it on my computer, and I erased it because I don't want any of that. And it's like all the horror, all these people all decked out, and tattoos and piercings, and they look all mean, but they're like, I can't deal with that.
What I'm about to say is not meant as an insult to the sci-fi crowd, because they're great.
Oh no, yeah, they're yeah.
I have found over the years that the crowd we get for horror is very, very intelligent and very hip in a way that is not. That's not like a weird, ironic way. They're very with it, and they're very together, and they're very responsible. Which is again, you know, the perception reality is totally different.
Yeah,
they really dig the extreme stuff. They get along with it, but they're about one of the nicest groups of people that I've run into, which is, again, why when we had the drink-throwing incident, it's like, what the fuck is this? You know? How did this happen?
Well, and I think part of it, I think a lot of it's the fan, because it's a fan mentality. You get more people are into horror, whereas, and again, sci-fi is not a bunch of jerks, but it's you get a little wider of a mainstream audience, but also, especially if you go back to this time, 1999 or so, this was before you would see obscure horror movie. You want to see Mr. Vampire.
Yeah.
This was your chance to see it.
Yes.
You know, now you can usually import a DVD or a Blu-ray, or you can find it online somewhere, or, you know, if you're going to pirate it, there's very easy ways to get that. And even more obscure stuff is much more accessible to just somebody living in Ohio.
Well, and I think what we've done too, to pat ourselves on the back, and this is bled into sci-fi a bit more recently.
Yeah.
Especially since Bruce and I started teaming up for both sci-fi and horror.
Yeah.
But for horror especially, when he and I, or when I was running it, and then when Bruce and I were running it, I think we had a real unifying vision of what we wanted to do creatively.
Yeah.
And in terms of features for the crowd, and in terms of the energy and what the tone and the mood we wanted to establish for horror.
Yeah.
And I think because we were able to do that, we helped to engender a lot of loyalty amongst a big, big chunk of the horror crowd.
Yeah.
And they really got that, and they dug it, and they loved the event, and they realized this is something really cool, and we want to make sure it keeps going on.
Yeah.
And the horror crowd has been great over the years. Again, we'll go back to the drink throwing thing. That's one of the only complaints I have had about horror crowd in the entire time that I've been doing these things. And that was such an isolated, small
weird
group.
And nothing. Yeah, it was not like, at all indicative of
it was,
the audience.
It was people who really hadn't been that much before.
Yeah,
and which is why I think the rest of the audience was a bit aghast.
It was a conflict of personalities in a small, isolated.
Yeah,
it was not. Yeah, you're right. It's not indicative of the audience. It just happened to be.
No. Do you have any other memories of the first Studio 35 Horror Marathon?
No,
Nightmare at Studio 35.
I remember liking it, and I'll tell you again from an audience perspective, because that's all I really was at this point. I enjoyed it, but yeah, it was just so odd doing the binge watch of horror movies in November.
Yeah,
it was weird. I didn't have kids at that time, so it was just me and my wife. She wasn't with me because we got married
She's
and that
smart.
Shit ended.
Yeah.
You know, and so I had to drag other friends to it. But it was as good of a marathon it was as it just seemed to be a little bit awkwardly placed in the calendar, and I know very exactly true. Why.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's you can move around a sci-fi marathon May, June, August, or you know, in the spring. But boy, horror marathon, that's got to be
absolutely
got to be October.
And it was
couldn't even be September. I don't think you'd get away with it in September.
Yeah, that's what I argued. We'll talk more about that. I know about 3 years from 4 years from now, that came up as part of the end of the Studio 35
yeah.
horror marathons. Yeah, and I now that I remember, it was the next year that you and I officially met for the first time, which I'm
yes.
sure we'll talk about on the next one. But
yeah,
so 1999, a very major transitional year for the marathons in general, and the year that the 24-hour horror marathon came back
to life.
And ever since then, there has been, with the exception of I believe 1 year, there has been a 24-hour sci-fi in the spring, and there has been at least a 14 to 24-hour horror marathon in the fall.
Yeah.
And it's been a nice rhythm ever since then. Now, how those have come about, where those have come about, the various permutations and oddball stories and mutations and all that that have happened along the way, those are other stories to tell.
Yes.
But at the end of 1999, it looked like sci-fi was beginning to come back a little bit, and the horror marathon was alive. And I remember looking ahead at the end of that first Studio 35 horror marathon and thinking, we got this done, now let's build on it for next year.
Yeah.
Now, what would happen was a very complex story, but we will talk about that on the next one that we do.
Yeah, it's a story for another day.
And another podcast. So, until then, from the great studio in the sky, the magical studio in the sky.
Suspiria.
Da-da-da-da-da-da.